listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 195 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me back across on the other side of the country is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. I think I'm probably at least five times more awake today than I was the morning we recorded our previous podcast episode on the final day of our conference after, you know, four sleepless nights and many sessions. And so, yeah, I'm good. I'm awake.
We were low on sleep, but there was tons of energy in the room. It was such an amazing time to be there with so many diehard podcast listeners. I feel like this year we finally hit it right, where it was the right size room and everyone was excited to be there, and we're like the diehards who listen to the podcast.
Well, there's one other element too, is that we've actually been recording episodes.
We've been doing that all along.
Yeah, but I feel like 3 years ago when the conference first started, we weren't doing it as regularly. So. I feel like maybe the audience is a little more tuned in now because we're more prolific.
True, indeed. And if you listen to episode 194, the one right before this, that was taped live at the DIY Musician Conference. If you haven't heard it, definitely check it out. And you can see a picture, a selfie we took at the very end of the episode that we used for the image for the episode. So lots of longtime friends of the podcast in that picture, and people that we've gotten to know as friends. So it was great to be there. So today's podcast, we are going to be talking a lot about our takeaways from the 2017 DIY Musician Conference and some of the experiences we had there. So we'll be discussing that. We have a lot of emails and a call to get to as well. And we have a news item. But first, I want to remind you that right now, we still have our $29 distribution offer going on at CD Baby. It's an amazing deal. You get access to the best music distribution, full service. None of these corners have been cut and eliminating some of your monetization options. It fully monetizes your music. Go check it out. Use coupon code GETMORE when you get standard distribution, or Get More Pro if you go pro and do the publishing administration as well. You'll save a lot of money, and your music will be out there worldwide. You just head over to cdbaby.com to get started, and we don't know when that deal's going to end. We literally don't know. That's not marketing.
No, it's quite true.
It's quite true. We have no idea when that's going to end, so take advantage of that. For all our podcast listeners, we just want to make sure you've got the line on all the good stuff. So there you have it. With that said, let's get into the news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Well, Chris, we just have one news item today. I didn't want to take up too much time with the news with all the comments we got. Huh?
How streamlined.
Yes, streamlined. So there was one news item that I thought was interesting and might play into some of the conversation a bit. Might not, but it was a good one. So here we go. How are 13 to 17-year-olds listening to music? Music Watch has released some new data. Unsurprisingly, streaming topped the list, with 41% of teens are listening to streaming services, a figure that includes ad-supported, YouTube, and premium streaming services like Spotify. Digital download files accounted for 20% of the answer. That was followed by a far older format, AM/FM radio, at 13%. So depending on the person, the methods for listening to music can vary greatly. Teenagers don't seem to really care about when a format was invented, as long as it's convenient. But it turns out most of the other convenient formats are newer, coming of age in the 2000s. And those are podcast at 2%, iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio at 2%, SiriusXM at 3%, music and social media came in at 7%, and music on the artist label website came in at 2%. And for reference, CDs came in at 3%. So I thought that was an interesting news item worthy of getting in this episode. As we've talked a lot about streaming, this is the future listening audience, the audience that are starting to engage heavily with music right now, and the people that will be dictating the formats and platforms in the coming years. So some interesting stuff there, some things I did not expect.
Well, I was waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to hear about physical formats. And you mentioned it at the end, and it was like a slightly higher percentage than some of the other methods, but like still 3% in total is almost, you know, it's negligible, to say the least.
That was for CDs. There was also, let me see, I forgot to put down the stat for vinyl. Vinyl came in really low, and yeah, vinyl came in at 1%, which makes sense.
So combining those two, it's a total of 4%. Right, for physical media.
Yeah, I don't think they had tapes or any other physical media on here. Yeah, you're correct. So the interesting thing was, like, one of the sources I got this information from, they were commenting how they invested in all these vinyl companies and how that might have been a mistake. And yeah, that the new generations aren't engaging in vinyl. I've never thought of vinyl that way. I've always thought it as a maturing music fan audience that wants to start collecting some key records, or maybe experience the world in even the CD era, where audio quality might have been perceivably different, and want to go back to where it was, you know, at its best. But a lot of these people coming up, I mean, I see kids walking around listening to sharing headphones with only like the right earbud in their head and the left in their friends.
Go back to mixing in mono.
That irritates me like crazy. I'm like, they're not even listening to half the stereo field.
Well, someone I'm going to mention later, maybe you will as well, I, who performed at our conference, interestingly, only pressed his latest album on vinyl and cassette. He didn't do CDs.
Interesting. Well, see, one data point that was intriguing, you know, at the conference, Tony Van Veen, who's the head of our parent company, AVL Digital, he did a little focus group on merch, and his big takeaway was that people think of CDs as merch. They don't think of them as a music format, a lot of the artists he was talking to. So the idea of, you know, what you have at your table is merch. So whether it's a CD or a tape or vinyl, there's a good chance whoever bought it wasn't going to listen to it in the first place.
Yeah, we've talked about that in the past. Yeah. It's kind of a memento.
Yeah, it's memorabilia. It's something to remember the show by, get signed. It's something to put on a shelf that's like to remember, you know, your favorite bands or artists. You know, some people still are listening to them, but with these younger audiences, clearly streaming is number one, which also includes YouTube. I didn't see a breakdown of that. I'm sure YouTube ranked pretty high. I would almost guess that if I had to, I'd wager that YouTube was probably 30% of that 41% of listening to streaming, something big, because it's free. So yeah, some interesting information there as we talk about shift in formats. The big surprise, I guess, was AM/FM radio. I haven't turned on the radio in my car to listen to music in ages, just because
I still listen to it.
I just can't deal with it.
I listen to NPR basically. Well, and occasionally I'll switch over to like the you know, the AAA, whatever they call it, kind of Americana light pop station, but mostly it's NPR.
I just listen to if I have to, I'll have NPR on, but I just listen to all their podcasts. So that it's just one of those things where the rock station in town that I used to like, every time I turn it on, they're just playing Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit. I'm like, how many times do I have
94.7?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that was the case when in our younger years, too.
Yes. They've simplified
like
their
years.
Processes and are just playing the same stuff over and over again. All right. Well, we are still basking in the afterglow of the 2017 DIY Musician Conference. And it was so amazing to see so many of you in person and get to hang out and hear about what you're doing and just grab a drink with some of you and just enjoy Nashville, and just enjoy being together as musicians. It's always a reminder to me, I think more so this year, how so many people, a lot of us in the artist community, we come from places where we might be the only artist we know, or we're in it from, some people are from a small town where there's not a big music scene. And even where I live outside the Portland area, I live in a smaller town, and it's like down on our little Main Street area, it's not like there's a scene or music. And sometimes as an artist, you can feel very isolated and alone. And one of the cool things was just being together, like-minded people, and just having a great time.
I completely agree. And I am in a similar situation. I live in a town outside of Portland, Maine, a smaller town, not a huge music scene. So it's nice to, well, first of all, it's nice to be in Nashville, which is, you know, the music scene. And then with all these independent artists, having a grand old time. It was awesome.
And so today we're going to do our five key takeaways each. But before we started that, you already mentioned is that how you pronounce his name?
I, yep. A-H-I.
I. He performed at our showcase. He also was selected to take part in the YouTube pop-up studio. All of these things happened independently. It wasn't like there was some big thing we had going on with him.
You know what? A third thing happened for him too. Bob picked his song for the song pitching session.
Yes. Bob picked his song for the song pitching session, where it was Bob Boylan from NPR, who does All Songs Considered, a couple music supervisors, and I believe some press. I can't remember. I was only able to pop in there for a few minutes. I had something else going on somewhere else. So he just went to the conference as an attendee and took advantage of some of the opportunities that we threw out there this year. And the cool thing was Bob Boylan loved his song and came out to the showcase on Saturday night to see him and loved that as well. But we have a picture of Bob up front taking pictures of I.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then Tuesday after the conference, featured him right off the top on All Songs Considered. And it was quite the feature. It wasn't like he just played a song and said, oh, yeah, this is I and blah, blah, blah. Bob talked about the experience at the conference at length and then did a very nice mention of I and how he found him. And so it was just this really cool thing that happened. And apparently they're going to have I do a Tiny Desk concert. So lots of really cool stuff happened, some, you know, success stories like that that we're hearing coming out of the conference. You know, we had that tagline, a bigger stage is waiting, that we used really just to symbolize that when you go to the conference and expand your knowledge base and your network, that bigger things can happen and doors can open for you. And this happened right at the conference. All these things happened because of the conference. And so it was really cool to see this happen. And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't like, oh, we've got this artist we're working with. Let's slide him in here and there and really give him a push.
No, yeah, he was on top of it. He submitted it. And then, so Bob liked his song enough to put it in the song pitching session.
Yeah, unrelated to anything else that we did, yeah.
And Ben liked him enough to be like, hey, you should play our showcase. It wasn't like this, yeah.
And then he just happened to be in the people that submitted for the YouTube pop-up studio. I looked at every single YouTube channel, and his met the criteria of having at least 300 subscribers and looked like he was actually trying to do something with YouTube, so I picked him. And so it was just a really cool example of, like, with persistence and all that, you know, just showing up and making things happen and writing good music, doors open, and that was a cool story. So you can hear that feature, the song that got featured on All Songs Considered. I think it posted on August 29th, I believe it was the Tuesday right after the conference. I know that's when I heard it, and I think that's when it was posted. So definitely check that out. And if you have any sort of success story or things that happened because of the conference, we'd love to hear about it as well. So be sure to hit us up if some cool things happened. And I think in some of the listener feedback and questions later on, we do have some of that. All right, so we've got our five takeaways. We each came up with five takeaways, key takeaways from the 2017 DIY Musician Conference. Chris, I'm going to let you start with your first. I don't have mine in any particular order, by the way.
Oh, mine either. But I'll start with Facebook Live. So I was walking around in the hotel getting back to do a session, and I rounded this corner in the lobby and I saw Rick Barker, one of our session leaders, just swamped by people. And I was like, what the heck is going on? And so apparently, I saw it later on the kind of rebroadcast of we streamed all the big room sessions. And anyways, he'd given this talk about an artist named Dawn Beyer, or Bear, I think it's Beyer, how she kind of got sick of blowing her voice out singing these long cover song gigs on Broadway in Nashville. And she decided she's just going to do shorter concerts on Facebook Live. She put up a PayPal thing. And anyways, in less than a year, she made $74,000. So Rick's talk was all about kind of how she did that. And he very kindly took the discussion out into the lobby. And he had tons of good tips. And I thought it was one of the most, there was the most energy around that topic, I felt like, at the conference. You know, maybe one of two or three things. But, like, for the rest of the conference, I was seeing all these artists then going on and just getting on Facebook Live and doing a couple songs and, like, I just thought that was really cool. He gave these actionable tips, and artists immediately saw the benefit and started trying it.
Well, that was one of my key takeaways as well. So I'm moving it up the list, even though I said there are no particular order. The big takeaway is that live streaming is just getting rolling. It's something that artists should be trying to experiment with and should definitely be keeping an eye out for developments in this area. What was interesting for us is that a company approached us, the conference, right before, like a couple weeks before, asking if they could live stream it. And we were like, we didn't budget for this. We're interested in the idea, but you know, we just didn't budget for this year, maybe next year. Well, they ended up showing up and saying, well, we'll do it for free this year because we need to get, you know, we're just launching our company and we need to get more more things, you know,
resume.
Yeah. So they showed up and I was just thinking it'd just be a camera in the back, but they developed this software where, you know, they tied into our YouTube channel and our Facebook page and had this incredible multi-camera shot going of live streaming our content. And it really kind of solidified some things in place for me going, oh, that's, I mean, I got the live streaming stuff, but just seeing it executed that way, and it was just someone with a laptop and a couple cameras, and realizing that this technology, it's, you know, it's needed a company like that to execute right now, but 5 years from now, I'm sure there'll be some sort of app with Bluetooth capabilities that allows you to sync a couple iPhones and do something where you can execute this real easily, and it's really great. The, you know, we had 1,300 tickets sold for our conference, and you know, I'd be taking a break from the conference and running to my room and checking my laptop, and there would be like 3,000 views for each of the sessions that were happening live. So people that couldn't make the conference were absolutely watching and engaged with it. You can still see all that content if you're interested. It's on the CD Baby YouTube page, and it's also on our Facebook page. Just go to the videos on both those places and you'll see them. And it's the content from our big room. But it's definitely something that artists need to be paying attention to, and that start trying stuff. It's okay to fail. It's okay to fail here. But just learn from it and don't make the same mistakes. But and also be paying attention to the technology as it comes down. You know, new things happen because it's really effective for getting your music out there. And like Rick was talking about, there'll be more options like PayPal or whatever to monetize it. I know this. There's a few things that I've been seeing in the rumor mill about Facebook that I haven't pulled into the news yet, but they are doing some things that I think Facebook is going to be an enormous monetization opportunity for artists in the coming years.
Yeah, I just had three quick things to share from Rick's talk and from Don's experience. So, if you're doing Facebook Live, some of their most important tips, one is just consistency, like make it a regular thing, whether that's weekly or daily or whatever, you know, like make it something that people expect. And then two is think as you're going live, think about recording for the replay and don't get so wrapped up in and kind of the who's watching in the moment, because maybe the first time you go live, there's one person or nobody watching. But basically just sell it and deliver your songs or whatever it is that you're doing as if there's 1,000 people watching, because later that day you can share that and target it towards certain audiences. And maybe by the end of the week, you will have 10,000 people watching something that when you did it live, no one was watching. And then the last thing was that Rick said, start doing whatever it is you're going to do right away. And then in our previous podcast, I said, just wait a little bit. And Ari Herstand tweeted, and
I saw
like,
that.
You guys are totally contradicting Rick. What's going on? So I didn't mean wait that long. What I meant was like, if you're going to start playing a song, like give us like 5 seconds to unmute the video, you know, like, Matt Wheeler, when he does goes live on Facebook, I think he does like a finger countdown. Other people will hold a sign up with, you know, like their artist name or whatever, just something to like give us a moment. But you know, don't be like fiddling around for 2 minutes before you start. That's not what I meant. Hopefully that clears up the confusion.
Yeah, and I think we clarified further on in that podcast. Yeah, it's just a matter of don't hit go live and start playing instantly, because sometimes your computer takes a second before things are actually broadcasting. And that's all we were saying, is like, make sure you're actually broadcasting. Yeah, I mentioned in the last episode that I've seen a live feed where like all I saw was a camera pointed at this room in a weird spot. And I think there was a sign and I saw someone walking around in the background and I'm like, what is going on? Did somebody's webcam accidentally turn on? Am I like about to witness a murder or something like that? It was just this weird, weird thing. It felt very voyeuristic. So that's not what we're talking about, you know? So yes. Also, I was going to say something. Oh, your point about don't play to the number of people there. Yeah, absolutely do not make comments like, well, it looks like there's only 5 people watching. Because one thing I've noticed both with YouTube Live and with Facebook Live during the course of us doing this, a bunch of live streaming at our conference, is that they when you click on them, it's as if the live broadcast is just starting, even if it's already been in progress. Some of the ways it like features it again. So you have to assume that part of the audience will be experiencing it as if it's live, I'm using air quotes, but it's really not live. But in their mind, the way it's being presented to them, it still is live. And I saw this with another band yesterday. They were doing something, a live video for hurricane relief for Hurricane Harvey. And I clicked, they're like, we're live now. And I clicked on it and I realized I could fast forward like 40 minutes. But at first I thought I was watching it actually live. So yeah, don't make comments like, dang, only 3 people are here. You want to communicate to the audience, but don't act as if the only people that are there with you truly live are the only ones that are going to see it.
Yeah.
So yeah, live streaming, big takeaway. I think we'll have a lot more of that kind of content next year. At least I hope, and I hope that the technology advances some where there's more DIY, like nuts and bolts. Here's how to set up the rig. Here's how to execute it and all that. So good stuff.
You know, while we're on that topic, I actually have a question for you and listeners, which is Don, who was the example of the singer-songwriter who earned all this money, does the kind of initial original version of the live camera shot where it's in portrait, I think you call it. It's kind of the long thin.
Mm-hmm.
And other people do the kind of landscape wide angle one. And so normally I'm totally against the tall thin one. I would always advise people to shoot in landscape, you know, hold your camera the right way. But something about how she's done hers, the way it kind of displays on your phone if you're watching on mobile, and also, I don't know, something about the framing of that when she gets real kind of her face close up, it feels more intimate that way. So basically my question is, what do people prefer when they're watching a musical performance through Facebook Live?
There are few things in life that get me super irritated. One of them...
You've answered my question.
One of them is when I see people pull out their phone and shoot video vertically, especially if they're in my band. In fact, we were in the studio and
that's not immediate grounds for firing them.
No, it's not. It's just, we were in the studio and I actually was in the middle of a take and they pulled out their phone, started shooting vertically. I had to stop. I'm like, you got to film that horizontally. If you film that video vertically, it's totally unusable. I just despise it because you cannot, our TVs are horizontal. The way our eyes look at the world is more of a horizontal picture, landscape being that, you know, landscape. And so whenever people video vertically, it might look great on a phone, but it just drastically limits it to that phone, where if you want to use it in any other video of your band, like on a YouTube video or any other video platform, you can't really, you just have a slice of the screen.
Right.
And apparently everybody who captures news on the fly these days is shooting video vertically, because every time you turn on the news, there's like the little slice of the screen, an eyewitness caught this, and there's a little slice of the screen, and then these, you know, there's apps and effects now where you can do it so it like makes it, fills in the rest of the screen so it doesn't feel so empty. But that's my preference. There's other things I get upset about that are more important, but that one is just like, why? Why do people film that way? I know Snapchat and Instagram stories film that way. And
I think the only thing that gets you more up in arms is people wearing shorts on stage.
It's a toss-up. It's close. It depends on what day you catch me.
Well, yeah, if listeners have a preference, I imagine most people will side with you. And
no, I mean, if you're shooting just for Instagram stories, that you actually have to shoot vertically. They make
Right. So, but I mean for Facebook Live, because you do have the option doing it either way.
I just think if you're going to shoot a live video, you want it to live in as many places as possible. And you can take that video from Facebook Live and, one, it'll be archived on your Facebook page as a regular video. You can put it on YouTube. You can, you know, put it down Instagram. And if you shoot it vertically, it's just really hard to see in those formats. So that's my opinion. I'd love to be told I'm wrong on that one by someone who has a good point, even though I'm not wrong. All right, next up. What's up? Yeah. What's your next one?
Okay, am I doing all five of mine first?
Well, that's fine. You can. We started with you, and then I jumped. One of mine was live streaming.
Oh, that's right.
So.
Okay, great. Okay, so I'll pat myself on the back and say that I had a great time doing two sessions about building your presence on Spotify, and the rooms were packed, and it was a lot of fun. I felt like there was a lot of enthusiasm, and I heard from a ton of people afterwards that they got a lot out of it. But there was one moment, and both times I did the session, where I could hear kind of a little breath in the room, like, you know, something just kind of, some lights went on in the audience. And that was when I'd say, never share, actually the first time Ben Hubbard said it, but never share a link to a single on Spotify. Yeah, well, people are like, what? Anyways, the answer is, instead of sharing a link to a single, add that single to a playlist that contains a bunch of your other music, and when you link to the playlist, they hear the song, and then they go on and hear more of your music, instead of it just kind of, you know, Spotify starting to recommend whatever they think you should be listening to. So it's like a small, tiny thing, but it seemed like a moment in both of those sessions where artists were like, oh, I never thought of that.
That's good advice, and it makes perfect sense. And for artists, on top of what you're saying, I would say that you should probably have one playlist that you just continually update to do this with, because if people start following the playlist, you know, you might build a little momentum there.
Yeah, exactly. And you're always putting your newest song at the top of it.
Yeah, and arranging what comes after it. Yeah, that room was packed. I tried to get in and I couldn't. I opened the door. It had been going for like 15 minutes. And it was standing room only, and this wave of heat, probably like 15 degrees warmer than the hallway, just flowed out and hit me, and it smelled like a locker room. So,
well, I did have a jacket on, so that could have all
been
coming
from
me.
Well, it wasn't you. It was the collective of that room being so packed. It was jam-packed. Well, I had a key takeaway that kind of goes along with what you just said. Mine was that everything with the music industry now is platform-based. And, you know, most of them are strictly music platforms like Spotify, Apple Music, and so forth. And that's a big shift. And it seems like an obvious shift, but it means these platforms matter and how they work really matter. And understanding the nuances of them matter. And we talked a lot about it on our Streaming Myths Debunked episode. And the point of that episode and a lot of the stuff we talked about there and a lot of like what you were talking about with Spotify at the conference, and I know Charles talked about playlisting and whatnot, is that these playlists or these platforms work a very specific way. And you need to pay attention. And there's opportunities based on how they work, and they don't all work the same. A lot of them are very different. And so there could be opportunities for your music just based on how these platforms work. That's a very big shift in the mentality and mindset of how artists pursue music promotion in the past, where a CD worked the same. No store had an advantage on how the CD worked or how the CD got purchased. Same with downloads. They pretty much, you went there, you bought it, it was on your device, you listened to it. Where some of these platforms have things working in the background that if you understand the options can drastically improve the performance of your music there. Whether it's playlist, whether it's just algorithms, how often you release music, how many fans you have, how much interaction your music gets. A lot of these things can matter, and understanding that and choosing to recognize that how this is different can be a big advantage for you. And there's a lot of artists that still refuse to accept this fact. That everything now is music platforms. Platforms operate a certain way. They have pros, they have cons, they have differences. And when you recognize that, you can start exploiting the goodness in your favor.
Yeah, and this is probably inherent in what you just said, but all of them have different tools that they give you in order to interact with your listeners. So, you know, what you can do on Spotify is very different from what you can do with Pandora's artist marketing platform, even though they're both very cool, like powerful tools that you can shape how your music is presented, but they behave very differently.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Another thing that a lot of these services, Pandora and Spotify especially, I'm always very appreciative of them opening up the data and giving it to artists. And I think Spotify's even said that this data should belong to the artist because it's their fans. And allowing people to see what's happening on those services. And a lot of that data, you know, we provide through your CD Baby member account as well for Apple Music, iTunes, and Spotify. And the one thing that I've said before on the podcast is I'm always very surprised how different the interaction with our music is on Pandora compared to Spotify, compared to Apple Music. And certain tracks will have a different life on different platforms. It's very weird, and it's because they're different. They have different algorithms. They have different user bases. And sometimes the way people interact with that platform drives music differently, and it's important to pay attention. So we're up to number three in no particular order.
So for me, this is the third year Tom Jackson's been there. I've seen him do his full band makeover now three times. It's always awesome. But he also this year did a solo performer makeover, which is basically, you know, he gets someone to play on stage and then he goes to town just sort of deconstructing and, you know, trying to make the visual and the audio more palatable and more engaging for the audience. But one thing I'd never realized about what he was doing before with the full band, it was somehow more focused and clear with the solo performer, is that as he's trying to get you to, you know, blow up the way you usually do things, he's not introducing like totally new elements. Basically, he took this one woman's song and he stripped it down and then he rebuilt it using all of the elements that were already there. He didn't change the melodies. He didn't change the groove. You know, he might have had you repeat something a few more times or like take a hook that happened in the beginning and wait till the end or whatever. But like, I thought it was really cool that basically like all the raw materials were there and it was just this playing with what you already have. And I could see that that was somehow comforting for these people on stage as they're being, you know, critiqued in front of a live audience, that he wasn't going to like force you to do something that wasn't already yours. It's just like, so I thought that was cool. Like maybe if you're a performer, think about it that way. Like in what ways can I use what I already have smarter or, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was my experience when small town poets used Tom Jackson way back in the day. The label brought him in because we had a 25-minute set. We were the opening band of a big tour. And they wanted to make sure that our performance actually was memorable in 25 minutes. And so it wasn't like he had us learn a bunch of different stuff or change chord progressions and all that kind of stuff. It really was thinking about how what we were doing would translate better in the live show. So for what you're talking about, Tom Jackson did two sessions this year. He did the live band makeover, which is what we've had in past years, but he also did a session, I think it was called How to Put on a Great Show Without a Band, something like that. I don't have the title in front of me. But it really just focused on more of how the arrangement of the song needs to be different in a live situation so that people can enjoy each element of the song. And I think to the artist, I know a lot of artists hate the idea of, you know, when Tom's saying, you know, you guys should come over here and move to the back while the guitar player is doing the solo. People are trying to figure out what they're supposed to look at. And I know a lot of people absolutely hate the idea of that. It's to your detriment, but okay, at least if you're going to pay attention to anything, the how you put together the arrangement of a song live can greatly enhance how your audience in a live setting perceive the song, because they're not listening in their car. They're listening. It's in a different environment that's usually louder, or there's distractions and material that they haven't heard before, and how you can tweak your songs to really make the performance grab them. And yeah, in that singer-songwriter makeover, it really highlighted that fact.
Yeah, well, and also singer-songwriters are very precious. You know, we're sensitive and so like you want to say like change your song, it's frightening and offensive and like, but so what I think was so cool is basically what he's doing is like, you're still being true to your song. You don't have to do anything that isn't yours. Just, you know, make a few tweaks. And I think that, for me, I've always loved what he's done, but like thinking about it that way made me more enthusiastic about trying to think about my own music that way.
Well, if I could sum it up in one statement, it's probably the idea of letting your music breathe in a live setting. And the execution of music live is different than listening to a record where everything's controlled and the performance is controlled and things have to be in time, otherwise it sounds like chaos. But in a live setting, you can really add the emotion and feeling by changing some things or letting some things breathe, taking some things out of time and letting it hang. And it's, yeah, it's just really felt like, oh, I took this song that was this tight 3-minute pop rock song that sounds great on a record, and I opened it up and turned it into this 6-minute experience that didn't feel long. In fact, it was just more and more of all the goodness of the pieces of that song.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always a good magic trick he does. It works every time.
I know.
That's what you told me after you walked by right after. It still works. Worked every time.
Right. That was in the full band.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Like,
these tricks, they work.
All right. I didn't have anything related to the live band makeover. My next key takeaway was less about, this one was less about an individual session, but just watching artists the whole weekend. And like we said at the top of the show, we had more opportunities for people to perform this year. And I was just blown away by the level of talent that we were seeing at the conference. And one of my big takeaways is, one, you got to pay attention to what's going on around you. You've got to show up and you got to follow directions. And the people that paid attention to what was going on around them, showed up, followed directions, their chances were so much better of being selected for opportunities, just with the conference itself. Selected for opportunities. Some of these opportunities we offered, you know, the 1,300 tickets sold, only a handful of people actually did those things. Showed up, followed directions and paid attention to what was going on around them in a way where it's like, hey, there's this opportunity. I want to get on that. Oh, I'm going to do it like they ask. I'm going to pay attention to detail and make sure that this is where I actually can plug in. And it's so crazy how much people just don't do those things. But when you do, your chances go up of having some sort of success, opportunities and doors open for you. Your chances go up, I don't know how much percentage. I can make up a number, 100-fold. I don't know. But I feel like for me, you know, I've said on the podcast many times, I went to Belmont University. I was a guitar major. I was definitely in the lower third of talent there. Some of you that were in Nashville for the first time for the conference, you might have experienced how that town, it's like you thought you saw, knew what a talented guitar player was. Then you go to Nashville and you're like, I really need to adjust my measurements here because I've seen a whole new stratosphere of talent I never knew it existed. But I was amazed at how many of those talented people refused to pay attention to what's going on around them, refused to show up and participate. And what I mean show up is like putting yourself on the line, like trying and sometimes failing, but just trying and being there. And then following directions on how you, you know, access different opportunities. And those that do will see good stuff happen.
Well, yeah, we talked a lot about IE already earlier, but one of the things I was going to mention is that he did everything you're talking about. He was aware of the opportunities. He followed directions. He put himself out there. He took advantage of all of them. And then, you know, most importantly, but importantly last, if that makes any sense, he was great. So, like, you know, that's still important, of course, but, like, if you're equally great, but you don't do all the things you just said, no one's going to hear you. No one's going to care. So you kind of have to do all that other stuff to show people how good you are.
Yeah, and being great, I would say, is a sliding scale because what one person thinks is great, another person might just be like, yeah, it's okay.
Sure.
So it's, I think why I mentioned that is it's easy to start comparing yourself to other artists and going, well, they're better than me, so I have no shot, you know. It's subjective. And yes, you should be working on your craft. You should always be getting better. But it's amazing how many people that you might come across that are amazingly talented just don't show up and try and seek out those opportunities in the right way. So that was something that was very apparent to me, that there was so much great talent this year that was bubbling up that I'm like, wow, I never would have known these artists existed, but they put themselves out there and approached the opportunities properly, and now they're getting a door open for them.
Yeah, and you mentioned comparing yourself to other artists and stuff, which kind of leads into my fourth takeaway, which is something I felt in general about the conference and then also very specifically about your conversation with Mary Gaucher, which is there's no point in being anything besides yourself. Like, I feel like we spend so much time thinking about what we're not as artists. We're not as good a lead guitar player. We're not as good a singer. You know, it could be a million different things that we don't have. All the while we're looking outward, we're forgetting that what we do have is completely different from what everyone else has. And that's like our biggest asset, the thing that makes us us. And Mary, I think, expressed that so well in her conversation with you, just how authentic she was and how protecting that authenticity was essential for her happiness, you know, but also I think what led her to be successful. And she speaks her mind, she shares her truth, and, you know, she's not, I mean, I absolutely love her voice, but I wouldn't say she's got, like, the kind of voice that most people would be like, oh, she's a great singer. That didn't stop her at all. She was totally true to herself, and because of that, like, I connect with her voice so much more than someone who will win American Idol. And I think that's kind of the general artistic takeaway about that, but I think it can also be applied to, like, the business side of things and marketing. Like, if you are inspired by, who knows, Instagram, like, follow that. Be true to yourself there. And if you hate Twitter, well, don't be on Twitter, because eventually your profile's just going to look dead. And so anyways, be true to yourself.
Yeah. My number four, I wrote this down as my number four. From my talk with Mary, that authenticity is more important than ever. And one of the things she said was, anyone can make a perfect record. So I can't remember her exact words, but...
Oh, she said, so what's the
point? So what's the point,
right? Yeah. Anyone can make... Yeah. Oh, man, I almost started crying when she said that.
Yeah, that...
I actually almost started crying like three or four times in her talk.
Yeah, and that we're in a Pro Tools world... It's easy to suck the soul out of music. And it's hard to explain what that means, but you know it when you hear it. Like, this music has been so, I don't know, processed, manicured to be perfect, that it feels like it doesn't feel like it's got any human emotion behind it. In fact, we were, when we were in the studio recording recently, I mean, one of my guitar parts, when we were listening to it, it felt fine. And, you know, there was a little bit of movement at one spot. And we looked in, I'm like, yeah, that right here is a little off. But I kept listening. I'm like, it sounds like a real person played it. Just leave it that way. We can scoot everything up to be perfectly on the beat, and it'll feel like a machine played it. But let's, you know, some of these spots... where we have the tools to make perfect, let's just let them be. Our original Small Town Poet records, you know, they were done on tape. So all you can go on is what you hear and feel. And I'd probably be embarrassed if
I... 10 years
yeah.
later.
What was that?
When you listen back 10 years later, you're not going to hear those imperfections, because that's just going to be what it was. Like, you're only...
And I don't hear it as imperfections, but I bet if I put it into Pro Tools and zoomed in, I'd be like, oh my gosh, none of us were together. But it wouldn't be that bad. But it's just...
That's always like the joke of, that music looks wrong.
Yeah, that music looks wrong.
Don't look at the sound, the wave.
Yeah. I thought the idea of like... the authenticity, and also what you said about, you know, no one can approach music like you can as an individual. It doesn't matter the level of talents. No one sees the world exactly like you do. Nobody has things to say exactly like you do or plays, and that's okay. Embrace that. Don't look at it as a weakness.
Yeah, and if we're being honest with ourselves, then we are better judges of our music often. I guess this isn't always true, but then what our perception is of what other people want and expect from music. Like, if you wrote some crazy lyric that kind of doesn't make much sense, but you love it and like it makes sense to you, but you kind of have it in the back of your mind that, oh, that's not going to be commercial because it's not super like, who knows what, like if you like it and you're proud of it, like keep it, because there'll be a market for, there's a market for anything. It does, you know, don't always be shooting for what you think someone else is going to like.
Yep. Also, from my conversation with Mary, one thing I was going to highlight, and I can't remember how much she went into it at the actual conference. I know she talked a little bit more in detail in my pre-interview call with her that I had, but the idea of she feels like one of her songs that's been recorded by several famous country artists and has done well for her is just coming into its life, meaning that this song she wrote 20, 25 years ago is now just starting to blossom, and that the idea of all your songs and your catalog are important. And oftentimes we tend to look at our catalog as like, what's the latest and greatest? But if you're writing great songs, usually they'll be very timeless. Sometimes pop music can pigeonhole itself just because sometimes it's too makes too much reference to the now. But if you're writing great songs, that they could have a life beyond the initial release, and you need to keep working with them, not keep redoing them and keep releasing them, but understand that they can find a life in a way at any point, and that your back catalog isn't dead music whatsoever. So it was pretty interesting to hear her talk about that and how she thinks the song is just starting to reach what its true potential will be.
Yeah.
She didn't really go into cool. it. I know she didn't go into that much detail in my interview with her, but on the phone call, I I was trying to get it there at the interview, but it kind of went a different direction. But that was something to just hear her talk about. I'm like, yeah, that's really cool. I mean, a song that was good 20 years ago and that has a timeless nature to it, it can come back around and have an even bigger audience. So we're down to number five. What's your last?
All right. So my last one is that the relationship matters first and foremost. Whether you're any good matters last. And why I'm thinking of this is that, you know, it's a huge networking event, this conference. And so everyone shows up wanting to give out business cards and download cards and CDs and all these things. And Rick Barker in his talk said, you know what? Don't give me a CD. If you come up and try to give me a CD, I'm going to tell you, no, keep it. I don't want it. I don't know you. I don't care. When I care, I'll come get your music. And it's so true. You know, I come home with, sorry to offend anyone that gave me like download cards or whatever, but I come home with 25 or 30 or 50 of these things. Like, I can't listen to all that. And also, I don't really know you. The exception to this is a woman named Helen O'Shea, who I've met at previous conferences, and we were friends online. So, you know, we have a relationship. We know about each other's lives to some degree. And she came up on the last night of the conference and she said, you know, I know your father passed away recently. I have a song on my recent CD that, she wrote about that situation in her life, losing her dad. So she gave it to me and she's like, I want you to hear this. And now I've been terrible. I haven't listened to it yet 'cause I've been so busy, but of everything I brought home, that CD is right next to my computer because I'm going to listen to it because the relationship matters to me. I don't know if the song's any good, but I'm definitely going to listen to it. So anyways, all that to say, stop trying to sell, push, promote. Just make some friends. And I think our conference is actually really good at creating that kind of environment. People, I think, walk away feeling like friends first. And then later, 6 months down the line, maybe they'll tour through each other's towns or go on tour together or collaborate on something. But it's all about meeting each other and just being humans first.
Yes, agreed. And especially with the relationship being important. You know, I've said a lot that the music business is still a relationship business. And a lot of times people say that in referring to, you know, opportunities a lot of times are enhanced if you know more people. Or the idea that if I don't know any club bookers in my city, well, obviously I'm not going to get any gigs. And once I meet them and know them, my chances of getting gigs go up. And so people think about that. But I think in general, music is a relationship business. And it's about communicating. It's about feeling emotion and human feelings. And if you just turn it into a cheap sale, it doesn't really turn people onto the music very much. I know Mary talked around some of those themes as well. I was thinking about it as it relates to this podcast because, you know, I met so many people that listen to the podcast and so many people at the conference will walk by and they'll hear me talking and they'll stop and go, you must be Kevin because I recognize your voice. And somebody was like, you and I go on runs together. And just that thing, I'm like, I know that feeling because I'm a huge fan of a lot of podcasts as well. And this weird sense of like this idea that I know this person that I'm listening to, even though I don't, but if I saw them walk in the room, I would feel like this instant bond because they've spent some intimate moments with me, whether every day on the way to work by myself or jogging or exercising or, you know, road trips. It's like, in this weird way, you've come along for a lot of the life journey, and that's how music is as well. And we sometimes cheapen it by just trying to make it a sale instead of the idea that the people that like our music are interacting in it, with it in some very personal moments, and a lot of times we forget that.
Well, you, the thing you just said was one thing I was going to mention later about just a positive and also strange experience about the conference for me is, you know, people like Harbor Drive Hookup and David Page and this guy Dylan, who I think he makes music under the name Hello, I'm Dylan. People that kind of, they feel like they know us because, as you said, like we're in their ears for sometimes hours at a time if they're like binge listening. It was so cool to get to meet them, and you get the sense that they have this familiarity. And in some ways, like, you know, we're Facebook friends or whatever, you kind of know them too. And then that did leave me sometimes feeling a little bit bad about, in a way, we're also like event planners and have to like, oh crap, I got this thing I got to run to. So I sort of constantly felt like I was leaving these conversations with these great people, which made me feel bad. But all that to say, if you're listening and, you know, you feel like you know us, just friend us, keep the conversation going online, because next year it'll be like, you know, like I was saying with Helen, like I feel like I know her, and let's make the relationship two-sided, because sometimes I feel like we're doing the talking and they're doing the listening, and I'd like to do more listening.
Yeah, it is hard at the conference to spend a lot of undistracted time with folks because we are running a giant event, and oftentimes they're like, hold that thought. Something's breaking over here that I need to go fix right now before it falls on someone's head. You know, that kind of stuff is happening. Or
I was talking to David at the last night of, where was that? The Tin Roof. And he was talking, and I realized I was looking kind of over his shoulder at Anna, at one of the CDBA people. And I'm like, crap, I have to go because I think we ran out of drink tickets. Like, so exactly the thing.
Hold that thought. Yes. My last takeaway, I don't want to, I mean, you got us on this emotional thread here now. I feel like I'm ruining the vibe, but that YouTube is still king, and it is still so powerful in driving success for artists. We're still seeing it every day here at CD Baby, but it was so great to have the YouTube crew there in such force, really giving hands-on advice to artists. And the one thing that I think, especially about YouTube and why I say it's still king, and that you should definitely consider your options of how you use YouTube if you're an artist, because since they're ad-supported, they really need people watching the videos, and they need good performing videos to perform even better. And so they're creating a platform that is intended to drive usage of your videos and music, and is intended to reward those that are seeing positive traction. So it's really still a powerful, powerful tool that isn't going anywhere anytime soon. I know some people are like, oh, YouTube, I'm over YouTube. It's all Facebook Live now. Totally different animal. And that's why it's important to recognize platforms for what they are and not look at them as just, oh, video is video. But YouTube is still an amazing place. It's driving lots of activity, and they've got some great new features they're working on. And it's funny because this summer, a lot of the podcasts I listen to have kind of gone on a hiatus and such. So I've been like, man, I've got to find some new stuff. So I've actually been subscribing to a bunch of YouTube channels, and now I'm hooked on YouTube. But it's just, I think just like podcasting.
Do you ever sleep?
Not all that often.
I think all the podcasts you listen to, you have two kids, you're in a band.
Well, I do that when I'm in the car or, you know, the podcast.
To say nothing of CD Baby.
Or when I'm working in the yard or whatever. Yeah. But anyway, YouTube has kind of gone through the same process of podcasting, where it kind of went, started out rough, then kind of refined a little, went some different places, and now has kind of become this really focused place where content is done well and usually done a certain way. And so there's a lot of content and artists that are doing stuff there that is, you know, sort of like podcast replacement. It's so YouTube is still continuing to explode, and it's important that artists continue to, you know, look at their options there. I know it's not for everybody, because it's, you do have to be in front of a camera. And if you're just really awkward and shy in front of a camera, you may be perfectly fine in normal life, but then someone pulls out a camera and you shrivel up and hide. Maybe that's not the platform for you, or maybe there's some creative ways you can use it. But having the whole YouTube team there and hearing about some of the new things that they're working on, I think it's really exciting. The best thing was, I believe that is the largest group of artists they've ever been around at one time. And they heard a lot of feedback and worked with a lot of smaller groups and were so energized and took a lot of information back with them about things they needed to change to the benefit of the artist. And I thought that was a very proud moment for me and just the artist community as a whole, because it's been a lot of work over the years of trying to get these companies to recognize the independent artist community and hear their voice and understand that the way that success happens for us is possibly different than the major label artists, and how we use their platform and the things that would help us is different. And so it was so awesome to them to see them just like, oh my gosh, we got to come back next year, and feel like they were energized from the experience. That was a huge takeaway.
That's awesome.
All right, we did our five key takeaways. Then I said, let's have one or two things we enjoyed that basically might not be learning or just about the conference that we're still thinking about that was a key piece of why going to the conference is so worthwhile. So what were your...
Well, I kind of mentioned two of them, getting to meet podcast listeners and then wanting to at least, extend the offer to just let's be friends outside of this context too, so that next year or, whenever I see you again, I have some greater context for who you are. And then the other thing is I love being a tourist in Nashville. So in the past, 6 months there, I've gone to the Ryman, went to Third Man. On this trip, I went to the Country Music Hall of Fame, which is awesome. I did the tour of Hat Showprint, which was really pretty special, and like super historic business that does these sort of cutout press concert posters thing, and none of their equipment is older than I think 1947 or something.
So
it has that super
newer.
Vintage look.
You mean none of it's newer than 1947?
Oh, yeah, right. None of it's newer than 1947. So it's all very vintage, and the tour closes out. You get to do your own poster, which is pretty cool. Anyway, so I just liked being a tourist in that town, and since coming home, I've gotten hooked on that really awful soap opera called Nashville.
But at least now you recognize where all the places are.
Yeah, well, and I've always wanted to go to the Bluebird, so now that I'm watching this show and it's so central to the show too, like, I think next time I'm in town, I can avoid the kind of downtown touristy things because I've already done them, and I want to sort of explore the singer-songwriter, not underbelly, but, the sort of... The less recognized
the seedy underbelly
of
the singer-songwriter world.
Yeah, that's what I want to explore next time.
Yeah, the Bluebird is way out, nowhere near downtown, and it's kind of funny. I think on the show they make it look like it's more centrally located. It's just in some random strip mall alongside the road somewhere. The couple things I wrote, one I already mentioned, the talent was exceptional. But one of the cool things, we added this recording session at Oceanway Studios on Music Row. It's kind of a last thing
that was
added.
Great. Yeah.
And it's an amazing studio. You can see pictures of it online, and we've got a bunch of pictures that we've taken from it. I know I posted a bunch on our Instagram feed, and our conference wrap-up that we have on our blog has pictures of it. But we had this session, and it was another opportunity where we just put it out to people that bought tickets to the conference. We had this artist, Nicole Boggs, I believe her last name was. She had this great band, and it was like they do the kind of this blues, pop, some jazz influence, but just kind of straight-ahead pop music with a little bit bluesy stuff there. Great singer, and it's kind of music where the band plays down live. So we got them, and they set up a session, the whole band, and we all got to go and watch, and there was like 50 of us. There was two sessions. They did a different song in each session. There was like 50 people in each one, and it was really cool. And what was also really cool for me is, I'd never been in that studio before, but I've been in some big studios like it. But knowing that a lot of the folks that came to the conference that got to go in there have come from, small towns all over the country, some all over the world, and the ability to get inside a studio like this and see a session like this happen is just unheard of. And so that was really cool to get to watch people just like on Christmas morning, just watching this amazing thing unfold in this studio that's like a palace. So it was really cool to be a part of that.
Yeah. And the control room and the tracking room are both so spacious that even though we squeezed in however many people you said, like, I never felt cramped.
No,
it was room to move around, and it was pretty awesome.
And we are going to do that again next year, hopefully, and hopefully add some extra sessions so more people can experience that. We'll see what we can pull off. But that was a lot of fun.
Sort of leads me to one thing I was going to say about looking forward. This year was definitely bigger. There was more attendees, more sessions, more speakers, like way more nighttime music event, performance opportunities, more of that experiential stuff with the Ocean Way and Hatch Show Print Tour and stuff like that. So now that we've done it once in Nashville, previously it was in Chicago, it's nice to kind of have just a lay of the land and feel like we're on familiar ground at this point, so we can, offer even more, but still kind of keep the familial, communal aspect of the conference.
Well, let's get into some listener feedback and emails. If you had any key takeaways from the conference that you'd like to share, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And a reminder that a lot of the content from the main room is still available on our YouTube page and our Facebook page for CD Baby. So go there, check it out. I'm also going to be releasing a lot of the audio from various sessions. I recorded the audio of most everything, and I'm going to be releasing a lot of that down the podcast feed over the course of the fall. So you'll be hearing some of it coming up. Not sure exactly which ones yet, but it'll be a surprise. But that'll be coming. So speaking of takeaways, you had an email from David Page. You mentioned him, and he had some things that he said. Here's something cool, like that from his conference experience. I made changes to my set based on what I saw in Tom Jackson's panels and tried them out at my show on Wednesday. They were awesome. It was cool to feel the music in different ways like that. The audience responded really well, too. Next thing he said, based on what I heard at the Merch Cat panels, I made some organizational changes to my T-shirt, lack of organization system, and sold three shirts as opposed to one or none. And then the next thing he said, I used Facebook Live to pull my audience in and show them some of my merch stuff and ask them what they'd like to see in the future, actually planting a seed for later based on Rick's panel on Facebook Live. And the next thing he said is, I made some changes to my Gig Salad profile after getting a consultation with their staff and almost immediately got a quote request. So he said, there's tons more, but I'm sure I'll talk to you about it later. Have a good one. So it was cool to see. He learned some stuff, made some quick changes, and saw immediate results. That's what I like to see. All right. The next one. Hello, Kevin and the DIY Musician Podcast crew. That would be you, Chris. My name is Christian Esteban. I recently attended the DIY Music Conference in Nashville, and it was such a learning experience. So glad I attended. I even had a chance to perform at the conference mixer at the Tin Roof. Very grateful for that opportunity. Okay, here's my question. I want to get in on the NACA college circuit. Would you recommend that I join the association outright by paying the membership, booth, and demonstration fees close to $1,000? Or would you advise that finding a booking agent that is already a NACA member? By the way, I live in Indiana, and the NACA Mid-America Con is late October of this year. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on the topic. I hope this made sense. Thanks for the awesome podcast and everything you guys do at CD Baby. I responded to his email, but I told him that I would read it on the podcast because this is something where I'm hoping some listeners have some advice for Christian, because I didn't really have, I've never really had much experience with that. I know Ari Herstand may have a bunch of experience with them. I know he's talked about the college circuit at length, and I think it might be the NACA college circuit, which is like an organization that helps, you know, organize people that are putting on events at colleges, basically. And they need a lot of musicians. Do you have any advice for him, Chris?
I don't. I was just thinking about how, you know, I've played a bunch of colleges, but usually there's some kind of friend of a friend connection or like, you know, some way in which I've been directly in touch with the event planners for the school. So no, I don't know anything about NACA.
Okay. My advice to him was to go the booking agent route first to try and find a booking agent that's already tied into that community that will allow him access without paying a bunch of fees. But I would also, you know, I would search Ari's blog. I think it's aristake.com. I think he has some information about this and has experience with that. I would definitely, you know, try to plug into that circuit. If you're not familiar with what kind of opportunities colleges have, a lot of times they pay really well. And it's not based on, you know, popularity. It's just like if the organizer likes you and feels the need, a lot of times they have big budgets of like multiple thousands of dollars, and they'll fly you out, pay you $1,000, and you do the gig and you leave. So it's definitely something that if your music fits the type of stuff they're looking for, it's worth being interested in. So if anyone has information that they think would be good advice to pass on to Christian, you can leave it in the show notes or email us and I'll read it on the podcast or call our listener line. All right, we've got one more email and then a call to close it out. This is from Brandon Kellum, and he sent two questions, and they were numbered, and he said I could answer one of them or both. I'm going to answer number two. Question number two. Our band has been fairly successful in playing one-off national shows in our region. It seems that the promoters and touring bands like us, too, as we continue to get asked back for more shows. What we haven't found is how to translate that into touring as a support for a larger band. Instead, we're normally out there doing DIY headliners or taking bands of equal or similar pulls. So my question is, in your opinion, what are some good ways to approach getting on larger tour packages? Is it truly all in having a tour agent and or paying for the spot? Thanks for giving artists an invaluable resource for this ever-changing industry. Have a good one, Brandon. I would say, yeah, that's going to be a tough leap to make. It's good to have that reputation, though. So my next step advice would be, if you're trying to be considered as an opening act or an opening act on a much larger tour, you're going to need a couple things in place. First, that relationship of having had a good experience with them, I think, is great. And hopefully you built some relationships with them and hung out with the other bands and just chatted while they were there, and they like you and your band, and think, huh, these guys would be fun to be on the road with. So that's helpful, but that's probably lesser of an item on the to-do list, even though you need to take care of that. The thing that's going to be more important is if you start talking to someone about a national tour, they're instantly going to want to know your touring history in various regions. So what they're thinking is, yeah, it'd be great if the opening band we brought on the national tour with us was cool guys that we liked hanging out with, but it'd be even better if they've toured and have a draw in various regions that the tour is going, so we can expect them those ticket sales. If you don't have that, it's not going to happen. Unless the other thing would be, you know, you're working with a band and they do open up a slot that you can buy on the tour. And basically, those buy-ons, when you buy onto a tour like that, the money is going towards the tour support, whether it's marketing the tour or paying for production and whatnot. If you get into that, make sure you have someone eyeball the contract, preferably a lawyer, because you can get yourself into some hairy situations if you don't know what you're getting yourself into with all those details around a tour, and if things go badly or if the tour gets canceled, all that stuff. So those are some things that you can make it happen. But, you know, the relationship part's important, but that's probably going to be the least effective as far as getting a band. Unless it's like a band that's starting to get regionally known and they can tour a region better than you, and every show you do in like the big city is successful, then maybe you can work that out. You know, it doesn't hurt to ask. Just if you've got a band that you've played with and you'd like to be on tour with and you've got some sort of connection, just asking them can't hurt.
It's good advice. I have a question for that.
Yes.
Emailer. What I would like to know is, in when you're doing these opening gigs for touring bands in your hometown, besides just doing a good show and impressing people, like, what steps are you taking to get those people to become your fans and come to your local shows and stuff? I'm not asking in an accusatory way. I'm actually curious. I assume they're doing it, so I just want to know.
I'd also be curious to find out, Brandon is his name, how you're getting these gigs. Like, if you're getting a lot of these national touring bands and you're getting to open for them, what's working for you? What's the sweet spot? What's making the booking agents come to you time and time again? I know with a band I was in here in Portland called Hello Morning, we had a handful of those opportunities because we were one of the few like commercial rock type bands in Portland at the time, where a lot of it was beards and banjos. So when a national touring act came through that didn't have an opening band and they needed one, and it needed a rock band, we would get called sometimes. And that's how we got a lot of those. But I'd be curious to find out how Brandon's band's getting all those. And I'm sure everyone else would like to know as well. All right, we've got a call, and then we'll wrap it up. Here it is.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to say thanks again for the DIY Musician Conference and everything you guys do in the podcast. This is John from Harbor Drive Hookup. I really appreciate meeting you guys and just having fun. But I'm down here fishing at the river, and I listen to podcasts while I fish. And I'm listening to a different podcast, and they're talking about dealing with web haters. And I know that you guys have some web haters. You know, you're successful. I've been on your videos. You know, you get those comments and stuff where people, they think you're out for something bad, you know, especially if you start to make money. And, you know, you're going to have at least 10% of the guys said that people are just going to send you these FU messages, regardless of what you do. And how do you deal with that stuff? Do you respond at all? Someone leaves a comment on your YouTube and says, you know, the one I saw in your video says, "See, baby's a scam artist," you know, like, I don't believe you are. I believe you guys provide a lot of value, but I think no matter what you do in the world, people are going to hate on it. So just curious how you handle stuff like that. I know the internet's different. Most people won't come up to a show and say that, but, you know, do you ignore it? Do you delete it? How do you handle a situation like that? We haven't had much of that ourselves, but it's just something that we're going to encounter, and I've had it in other realms that I've done. But anyway, keep up the good work, and love to hear what you guys say about that. Again, John from Harbor Drive Hookup. You can check out our music at harbordrivehookup.com and our debut album, which we funded fully with Kickstarter. Thanks to you guys. You can check it out on Spotify. Like I said, we're Harbor Drive Hookup, and it's called Engaged by the Harbor. Thanks again. Have a great day.
Step one, get a pillow. Step two, scream into it.
And then cry yourself to sleep.
Step three. Yeah, I don't know.
I did have some advice pertaining to haters. One, no matter what you do, no matter how amazing you are, no matter how you are the model of the perfect human, there's going to be people that say rude, mean, inappropriate things online when you start having some success in some form or fashion. It doesn't even have to be like big success. When you try to put yourself out there and do something, people are just going to hate on you. And at first, it can be very frustrating, and it's hard to let it go. You can start obsessing over it and drive yourself crazy. But you have to understand that a lot of these people that do that have really horrible lives or something in their life that they're just so miserable that this is like, I don't know if it's like a release is not the right word. It's just, it doesn't excuse it, but it's like understanding that, oh, this person's life is so horrible that this is what they spend their day doing. I start to feel bad for them after a while.
Yeah, because I think about, I don't know when, if ever, I've taken a single second out of my life to hate on someone in that way, to, you know, to troll them or to leave a negative review of someone's like song or YouTube video. Like, I just don't have time for that. So like, if people do, it's really kind of like, I think you can almost immediately take it with a grain of salt because,
yeah,
exactly what you just said. There's something in their lives that's making them just.
There was a really good episode of This American Life where they dealt with that. And it was fascinating, heartbreaking, and at the same time, reconciliation happened. It was a really good episode, and it kind of illuminated the situation. We used to have a very big hater of the podcast who will remain nameless. And it was kind of fun for a while. If you've been a long time listener to the podcast, you may have picked up on it. And it got out of control where I didn't need it in my life. And I just blocked that individual and it went away. And so to me, I try to deal with some of it with good humor. But if someone is just like being abusive, I think you should block them. You should. There's nothing that says that you have to leave bad comments on your videos. Delete it. Get rid of it. You don't need that garbage in your life. And feel free to report them. Now, you don't want to go crazy and start reporting everybody. And there's a difference between a negative comment and someone being abusive, rude, mean, and just a terrible person. And so you got to deal with it and try to move on. You can acknowledge that comments hurt, what people say hurt, but if you obsess over it and engage in those conversations, it's a losing battle. So don't bother engaging. Just delete, block, move on, and know that it doesn't matter what you do on the internet. Someone's like that's going to start trolling you. And then, you know, then it's like have a little empathy for them that, man, your life is so terrible. You got nothing going on that this is how you spend your day. That's sad. And I don't want to see this, and I feel bad for you, and I'm just going to move you on out of my life. So.
Yeah, if you don't know the person, if you don't have any other context for why they're leaving these negative reviews or comments or whatever, like, it's tough call whether you, because sometimes it can be cool to just meet some negative criticism honestly and kindly and be like, oh, all right, you think that, well, you, like, thanks for sharing your, you know, don't use those words, but like, I like when artists are just confident enough in their material and in themselves to address and communicate with people who disagree with them or don't like their stuff. It shows me that I should probably pay attention to their music because they've got balls. But anyways, you know, that's a fine line though, because if you engage with someone who is just going to keep writing back, then eventually it becomes, that's like the feeding the trolls thing.
Yeah. And there's a difference between having spirited debate and engagement and disagreements than someone that's a hater. So and I think you know when the line's been crossed, and
yeah, you'll know.
And
quickly,
that's
right?
When you just have to kind of let it move on. So yeah, I'd be curious to find out if other artists have had issues or how they've dealt with it. And thanks for the call, John. Thanks for being at the conference.
Oh yeah, good to hang out with you guys.
Yep. Thanks for listening to the podcast. See, he takes podcast fishing with him. So John and I have been fishing. The three of us have been fishing together.
That'll be the first time I've been fishing in a long time. Also, they made a cool conference recap
yep,
video when they were on their way home from, I imagine they edited it on their way driving home from Nashville.
In Nashville, you can still edit video and drive. So it's in Tennessee, it's still legal.
I was assuming they, you know, were just milking every moment, so then they didn't have time to put it together until it was all done.
All right. Well, thanks for all the calls and feedback and questions. If you'd like to call our listener line, it's 360-524-2209. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, and you can go to the podcast website and leave comments in the show notes for this episode. I will say, if you call the listener line, please make sure, one, you're not walking, two, that you have good reception, and three, that you try to keep it brief. There was a couple extra calls, a couple that I would have liked to have used on the show, but the reception was terrible, or it, you know, they sounded like they were in the middle of doing something else, and I would have had to edit a lot to make it play okay on the podcast and not ramble too much. So just if you want to call, I love calls. I love hearing people's voices and letting their voice be on the show. But just try to have your thoughts together, keep it brief, and is, you know, 1 minute, it's good. One and a half minutes is a good length. And that way we can get on the podcast and your voice will be heard. So, well, it was so great going to the conference, being with people. I'm back to podcasting in a room by myself all alone, while you're on the other side of the country in a room by yourself all alone.
In a room all by myself, yeah. Well, you don't know that. I actually have 15 people just staring
at me.
That's
true. You probably do.
On couches.
You probably do.
Yeah. I have an entourage wherever I go.
All right, cool. Well, looking forward to the long year before the next conference, but we've got lots of podcast episodes coming from the conference and more, so stay with us, and we'll catch you next time. See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.